And now, live from New York City via Los Angeles, California, it's time for The View from Over Here with the man who has a view for all seasons, your host, Stan Weisleder.
Hi there, this is Stan Weisleder in the studio with Malcolm Berman on CRNTalk.com.
Right before we start, I have to make one more comment. Paul,
wake up.
The music. You didn't change the music. We want Gershwin music. Rhapsody in Blue. You hear that, guys out there? Everyone out there? Would you please write Paul or text him, remind him during the week that he has to put Rhapsody in Blue in. Okay, Stan, yeah, take it away.
Send him an email. Hey, I got one for you. This is really good. In fact, I think I got it from you, Malcolm. I guess you like this kind of subject matter. There's a law in Hawaii that permits their police officers to have sex with prostitutes while in the course of their duty.
That's called the intercourse of their duty.
Yes. Thank you. And also it permits them to submit their expenses for reimbursement. How about that?
Condoms?
Great work if you could get it. All expenses.
Paul, stop writing that application.
Anyway, listen, for quite a while now, our comments at the beginning of the show have always been dealing with light and frivolous items like the law in Hawaii, which is true, by the way. But some of our listeners have suggested that we owe it to our public to use our forum for the discussion of matters of greater significance.
Well, Stan, what I tell them is...
What say you, Malcolm?
They can go to CNN, MSNBC, Fox News. They don't want to talk serious, but this week let's go ahead with it.
All right, we'll give it a shot. Now, the New York Times, you've all heard about the New York Times. It's a very well-known, prestigious newspaper.
Communist newspaper.
Ooh, that's nasty.
Listen to Sean Hannity. Anyway,
they have an international edition for distribution in all other countries outside the U.S., including Pakistan. Now, Pakistan is a nuclear power where supposedly they still don't know how to repair a broken refrigerator. Anyway, when the New York Times international edition came out for Pakistan, they censored the article that detailed the relationship between Al-Qaeda and Pakistan and Pakistan's knowledge about Osama bin Laden's compound that was within its borders. Okay? So what does that tell you about Pakistan? Also, last week there was a very informative article that was in the magazine section of the New York Times exactly about the relationship between Pakistan, Al-Qaeda, and the United States. And if all that stuff is true, we may be fighting the wrong enemy. Anyway, let's go on. After World War II, okay, you remember Malcolm back? No, you weren't even born then.
I wasn't born
anyway.
Then.
There were some 200 women that applied to the LAPD, Los Angeles Police Department, of which 21 were accepted. And of those, 9 made it through the rigor of the training academy. And then it took another 2 years before they received the additional training that enabled them to be issued guns. Josephine Serrano Collier, who just passed away at age 92, was one of those officers and the first Latina officer in the LAPD. Okay? Mm-hmm. Worth mentioning.
Well, comment on the police. I know that with a gun, anybody is as big as anybody else. But for some reason, when I see the police, a policeman come out, whether it be a male or woman, who's like 5'2", somehow, they totally lack authority. I know the position has the authority, but I can imagine.
Just remember this, Malcolm. If you want to run, you can't outrun a bullet, right. no matter how short they are.
I wonder if that's how they got the expression. It's not size that counts. It's what you do with it.
I'm not sure. I don't know.
Never mind.
You want to be famous, Malcolm?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Tell me. Pray
well,
tell.
Then you have to have been born in the right place. According to the New York Times, who used Wikipedia as their standard, which may or not be the most accurate of methods, it shows that if you were born in New York or California, you have the best chance of becoming famous, and that is one out of every 500 births.
I was born in Brooklyn. Does that count?
Yes, that's New York.
Oh, okay.
Now, if you were born in Indiana, New Mexico, North Dakota, Virginia, West Virginia, North Carolina, or South Carolina, you had the least chances of becoming famous, or only one out of every 4,496 births. But also remember that these statistics do not apply in the case of born-agains.
Aha. Uh-huh. And now I can see this now creating a whole new migration. You know where people sometimes come to this country to have their kids born here so they become U.S. citizens?
Yes.
I can imagine someone from Indiana going to New York or California so that child could be born in one of those states.
Well, because of you, Stan. I don't know if it works that way.
And it's all your fault.
All right, let's get back to some of the things that are happening today. Back in Hitler's day, you all remember Hitler. He used the plebiscite technique when he wanted to take over a landmass that was adjacent to his own. Sometimes. This was an impartial vote of the residents that would dictate which way the country or a piece of the country would go. Now, just as there are Russians residing in the Crimea section of the Ukraine that voted for reunification with Russia, there are also any number of Ukrainians in Russia that have yet to vote. In a game of tit for tat, Ukraine should request a vote of those Ukrainians residing in Russia, asking them if they wish to be part of the Ukraine. And if that works, we could extend that policy to just about every country and vicinity and area and state in the planet.
I'm thinking of states. Didn't Mississippi want to succeed, or Georgia or the southern states? And in fact, they did a little while ago.
Well, they tried that around 1861, I believe. It didn't work out too well. Okay, lastly.
But not leastly.
No. Flight MH370 out of Malaysia has been missing for over 2 weeks. Not like something of this has never happened before, because back in 1950, there was an airliner that completely vanished while in flight over Lake Michigan, and there's never been a trace of that airliner to date. Of all the assets and technology brought to bear on behalf of Flight MH370, there has been hardly any mention, except maybe yesterday, of the U.S. Navy having taken part. Remember, an aircraft carrier can arrive on station faster than any commercial ship and put literally dozens of planes as well as helicopters in the air and keep them fueled and refueled almost indefinitely. And our submarines are supposed to have the most advanced and sophisticated underwater tracking and listening devices. Could it be that the U.S. already knows the whereabouts of Flight MH370?
Could be, but which I never realized. They said that we know more about the surface of the moon than we know about the underwater over the Indian Ocean. We don't know the typography of that. No one's ever been down there, even though we've been on the moon.
Well, that's,
and we don't know our own, yes. our own geological planes.
Yeah, it's very true, unfortunately. Well, any guess what you think may be happening with that?
Actually, my guess is probably as good as anybody else's guess. I mean, they have, we were talking before, the news stations are talking about this or, coming up with these hypothetical reasons that, what happened to the flight. And no one really has any basic facts. Everybody's guessing. I mean, it's we might as well say a spaceship abducted them.
Yeah, we could. But then again, that's stretching it a bit. But what the hell? Anything's possible. But the thing that is weird, that there wasn't enough proper transmission or sharing information between the parties involved at the outset. It was like pulling teeth to find out or to get information.
Well, there's something I remember hearing at the early days about that the plane went up to, I think it was 45,000 feet, and where they would have to give oxygen to the the people there. So I don't know if it just went out or, you know, went up to that height, and then everybody just passed out, and the plane flew on its own.
I'm not sure we'll ever know, but have you noticed all of the different experts on CNN? I didn't know we had that many experts in this country.
Yeah, well, CRN, all the stations. And I love, I think Bill Maher made the note of it, every time something happens, breaking news. But it's not breaking news. It happened, you know, it's repetition.
Stuff. Same old, same old.
But you have to keep the...
Anyway, I think it's time for our first guest for today. Paul in the control room is shaking his head. Paul, do we have Dan Pilla on board?
Yeah, he does. We do.
Dan, are you there?
I am here, guys.
Great. Okay. Our first guest for today is Dan Pilla, who wrote a book, How to Eliminate Taxes on Debt Forgiveness. Now, I remember back in high school, our teachers saying, the only things that are guaranteed in life are death and taxes. Well, we know that is not entirely true, because taxes, depending on who you listen to or in what book you read, they may be avoidable. Death, no, at least not yet. Anyway, Dan, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to pick this fight with the IRS?
Yeah, sure, guys. I've been a tax litigation consultant for over 33 years, and this is not my first book. I've actually written a total of 13 books on all dealing with taxpayers' rights issues, IRS abuse prevention and cure, and problems resolution. So, you know, for the last, as I say, I've been in this business 33 years, but I've been writing books for probably 25 or so years, plus or minus 25 years, on giving people the information they need to deal with IRS problems. You know, most people, of course, can't afford to hire tax professionals to defend them when they're dealing with IRS problems. And, of course, you know, if people had money in the first place, they generally wouldn't have IRS problems because they would just pay it. But, you know, so these books that I've written over the years are designed specifically to help people get the help and the guidance they need to deal with these IRS problems.
Okay, about guidance, where can our listeners get your book, and how much does it cost?
Yeah, the book is it's a workbook, 8.5 by 11 workbook, and it comes with a 1-hour CD, guys, on my presentation on debt forgiveness issues, and it's available at my website, which is taxhelponline.com. It's all one word. There's no spaces of any kind. Taxhelponline.com, or my phone number is 1-800-34-NO-TAX. That's 800-34-NOTAX. The book is $67.95. That includes the CD. It's a workbook with all the forms and instructions, everything you need to deal with a debt forgiveness problem.
And is it tax deductible?
And it's absolutely tax deductible, just like tax preparation fees would be. It's no different. In fact, any expense that you incur to educate yourself on the tax laws, or you know, pay a tax professional to help you, or return preparation, that sort of thing, are considered miscellaneous itemized deductions. They're deductible just like tax prep fees are.
Okay, now the IRS came out with Publication 4681, which covers your subject matter. So they're trying to give this information to their customers or clients free. So I assume that your book is better than their publication, but can you tell us why it's better and how it's better?
Well, there's two problems with the IRS's publication. First of all, when we're talking about the loss of property through foreclosure, first of all, the book, How to Eliminate Taxes on Debt Forgiveness, deals with all of the common exceptions to the debt forgiveness rules. The general rule is if you owe somebody a debt as a result of a loan, then that loan is canceled, then you have income to the extent of the cancellation. But the problem is the good news is that there are many, many exceptions to that rule. Now, when we're talking about property loss through foreclosure, there are specific calculations that can be made that show how to reduce or eliminate that debt cancellation income, which the IRS's publication does not go through.
Okay, hold on that for a minute, because we're coming up to a break, and we'll get right back to you. You're listening to The View from Over Here, heard on CRN Digital Talk Radio, and carried on the World Wide Web at crntalk.com. Stay tuned and hear our guest and find out how to deal with the IRS back in about 2-3 minutes.
Hi there. Stan Weisleder back at CRN Talk in the studio with Malcolm Berman and our special guest today, Dan Pilla. Dan, question for you.
Go ahead.
From what I understand, that all of this applies to the laws, let's say, through 2013. Will there be any changes for 2014, or will it still be the same?
Well, there are some changes. In the book, I discuss the most common exceptions to debt forgiveness. And if we can just let me wrap up what I was saying before the break about the difference between this book and the IRS publication. In addition to the statutory exceptions to debt forgiveness, in other words, the things that are provided for in the law, there's all kinds of different court-created exceptions to debt forgiveness income as well, and the IRS's publication doesn't address any of those.
Yeah, so, the IRS publication is just going to tell you how to fill out the form, not how to get around the tax.
Yeah, they don't give you the full spectrum of options that are available for dealing with the problem.
Yeah,
that's
why should
sure.
they?
And so now, as to your question as to what applies and doesn't apply in 2014, there's one aspect of the debt forgiveness rules that's important to folks who have lost their main home through foreclosure, if they've either lost it through foreclosure or short sale. And that is the Mortgage Debt Relief Act of 2007. Congress set up an exception to debt forgiveness that applies in the case of a foreclosure of your main home. However, that law expired as of December 31st, 2013, so it does not apply in 2014 going forward. However, if you lost your home in 2013 or any year before that through 2007, then the book shows you how to use that Mortgage Debt Relief Act. Even if the Mortgage Debt Relief Act doesn't apply, and this is what's important, and again, this is the difference between my book and the IRS's publication, even if the Mortgage Debt Relief Act does not apply to your circumstances, there are many other exceptions that probably do. And I'll tell you this, there are so many exceptions to the debt forgiveness rule that just about everybody qualifies for one thing or another, to the point where virtually nobody is going to owe taxes on debt forgiveness if they follow through with this material.
Hey, I got one last question for you before we close out. I know some of this material is simple for some people, and for others it's kind of complex. Can you, let's say, go through a simple scenario of how a tax on a particular or a typical situation might be avoided by people listening to you or doing what you propose?
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing, and this is consistent with the difference between my book and the IRS's publication. There is a rule in law called the disputed debt doctrine. Now, there's an awful lot of people that have credit card debts that have run up penalties and overdraft charges and so on and so forth that people dispute, and I see it all the time, and we've got situations all the time where people will maintain that they really don't owe this debt for this reason or that reason. It is very common, however, when a credit card company reduces a credit card debt, even in a disputed debt situation, they will mail a 1099 in. And now the IRS thinks that that's taxable income. The fact of the matter is that under the disputed debt doctrine, which I show you how to use in the book, it's very simple to apply it. When there was a legitimate dispute as to whether you owed the debt in the first place, that debt cannot be taxed as income to you to start with.
Well, they're sending that 1099 out to get even.
Well, I think they're sending that out to protect their backside from the IRS, see, because the regulation requires that in any situation where there's a quote-unquote reduction of debt, they're supposed to send that thing out. And I don't know. There's certainly cases where it may have been sent maliciously. I don't deny that for a minute. But for the most part, they just send it out because they think the law requires them to.
Yeah, this is one question. Now, if you do a short sale on the house, and let's say your second mortgage is forgiven for, let's say $200,000, how is that viewed by the IRS?
Well, their default position in any situation like this, guys, is that it's taxable income, and you have to prove it's not. And this is another important thing about the book, is it shows you exactly how to prove your case. You know, as citizens, we're inclined to think that we're innocent until proven guilty, and of course, if you're a drug dealer, that's true. But when you're dealing with the IRS, you always have to prove that you're right. The IRS never has to prove, rarely, I should say, has to prove that you did it wrong.
All right, Dan, we're running out of time. We have 60 seconds left. month. So please tell our listeners again, how can they get your book or books?
Yeah, the book, How to Eliminate Taxes on Debt Forgiveness, and all of my books are available on my website, which is taxhelponline.com. That's all one word. There are no spaces. Taxhelponline.com. Or my phone number where they can call and order the book, 1-800-34-NO-TAX. That's 800-34-N-O-T-A-X.
Well, thank you very much. And
very
I know it's,
good.
It's perfect for this time of the year. Thanks again. You're listening to The View from Over Here, heard on CRN Digital Talk Radio and carried on the World Wide Web at crntalk.com. Plus, you can get all back shows and information about who we are at www.viewfromoverhere.com.
Hi there. This is Stan Weisleder in the studio with Malcolm Berman on crntalk.com. And we are here today with our special guest coming on board now, Bill Friedman. Bill, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Bill has written a book, and I really went through the book. I didn't read every bit of it, but I looked and I scanned it, and I was really impressed. I liked this book. The name of it is All Against the Law. Okay? And real briefly, it has to do with the connections of the mafia and other miscellaneous gangsters and our politicians going all the way up to the White House. So, Bill, I have to ask you this question right off. What makes you qualified to write this book, and how did you come by all of the subject matter contained therein?
I became a casino dealer the day I turned 21, and I was fascinated.
Well, that's the name of the game, 21.
Pardon?
You became a dealer on 21 when you were 21.
You got it. And all of the men, the executives behind me in that era, had come out of illegal gambling. There was no homegrown industry in Nevada, so when hotels opened, they had to pull from the large illegal operations across the country. And these guys had led the most interesting lives of anyone I'd ever met. And so I got close to many of them, and over time, I got to know all the major gangsters, and what they said and what the media said were two different things. So I went back and spent the last 47 years reading 150,000 old newspapers, 200,000 pages of FBI reports, interviewed all the major people involved with gaming here, the owners, operators, the executives, the secret interests, the politicians, the gaming control, and this is the first book in a series that puts together all of this data.
Well, before you go any further, where can our listeners get your book, and how much does it cost?
The print book is at Amazon.com for $17.99, and all ebook retailers have it for $9.99.
I have a question for you. This is Malcolm. The other night I was just watching Casino, the Robert De Niro show. I don't know if you've seen the movie.
Oh, absolutely.
What do you think about that? Is that accurate or not accurate?
It is the closest thing to accurate Hollywood's ever done. You know, it was done as an entertainment, so I could quibble about a few facts. But the basic theme is correct, and that's almost never happens. Nothing about Vegas or organized crime is ever realistic out of Hollywood. So that, to me, is a stunning achievement.
And again, are you familiar with all the movies they make about Benny Siegel or Bugsy Siegel?
Yeah.
And how he started the whole thing?
Yeah, they always make him out as crazy. The reality was he was such an outstanding businessman that he could walk into any bank in the United States, and as soon as the president heard he was there, he would rush out hoping to do business with him.
Did you know him personally?
What?
Did you know him personally?
No, no.
He died too soon.
Right. My research started in 67.
Oh, okay. Now, I haven't had a chance to read the book.
I interviewed everybody who was associated with him in business in both Los Angeles and Las Vegas for the last 13 years of his life. And he's the only human being I've ever encountered. I couldn't get anybody, even his worst enemy who stole from him for 10 years and the dirty business things they did to each other over it. And even he said, on a personal basis, I can't tell you one bad thing about this man.
Hey, I have to interrupt you here for one second. I have a number of questions, but before I get to the questions, one question which has nothing to do with you or your book, but did you ever read my book, The Trees? It's a novel, two-thirds of which takes place in Las Vegas.
No, unfortunately. Okay. Everything I did because of my research was the fact stuff, but I will now go back and read that.
Please do, and I'd really like to know what you think about it. Now, question. I really liked your book, okay? But I see that it stopped short of the time of Howard Hughes and corporate America. So my question to you is, are you in the process of writing a sequel that picks up after this one left off?
What I did, because it's so hard to break into the publishing business, I took a side story. It keeps going back and forth from Reno and Vegas for the Depression years and the 40s, and that's a side story. The book, I have a series coming out, one a year, and next year it will be on the history of organized crime. No one's ever put together how it developed and how it operated. And the reason I had to do that, and then after that I will do a history. The next year will be the
30s. This is fantastic. Now, wait a minute. You're coming out with that book. When you come out with it, we want to get an advance copy, and we want to have you come back on the show and talk about it, because I believe that our listeners would be fascinated by the subject matter, et cetera, et cetera.
Guaranteed. But when I then come the 30s and 40s, and then come the 50s and 60s, the 30s, 1931, it was legalized. The reason why I've got one on just organized crime from the 1920 when Prohibition began till 1950, when the top leaders of Prohibition were building the Las Vegas Strip and using their Prohibition money and then their illegal gambling money. During the 30s and 40s, these same guys had elegant, illegal, wide-open casinos across America, far finer than anything in Las Vegas today. Some of them required the men to come in to gamble to have on tuxedos, and, of course, their wives were adorned in jewelry and furs.
Bill, don't go away. We have a break coming up.
And I have a question for you, which it takes, which you have to think. Why are people so fascinated with the mafia, prohibition, illegal activities?
And think about that for you as our break is in 15 seconds.
You're
Bill, don't go
the,
away. You're going to finish up the program
with
us. You're
listening to The View from Over Here, heard on CRN Digital Talk Radio and carried on the World Wide Web at crntalk.com. Whew, that was a mouthful.
Hi there, Stan Weisleder here in the studio with Malcolm Berman and our special guest today, Bill Friedman, who has written a fascinating book, All Against the Law. Bill, you're back with us and you're ready for some more of our questions, I hope. But Malcolm asked one right before the break, so have you thought about it?
I probably can't say it very eloquently, but...
Give it a shot.
People who abide by the law and the rules face a lot of frustration in life, and people who get away with things and can control their lives are a fascination. And that's where it comes from, the idea that The Godfather, which became so incredibly popular as a book and a movie, could control the people around him rather than be face all the heavy winds of life, has just a great appeal. Back in the Prohibition era, where this book is, I go over the four successive public enemies, number one, and their long fugitive runs, how they did it, how they kept escaping pursuits and jail. And the banks were very unpopular then because they were foreclosing on individuals, sure, on businesses, on farms. And these robbers, and a quarter of America was unemployed. A great deal of the rest of America was very worried about the future.
Yeah, they were like Robin Hood, except they didn't give it to the poor. They kept it for themselves.
That's right. But some of them were very clever. Dillinger, for example, when he'd come into the banks, all of these guys used machine guns. Whenever he'd come into the banks and anyone would reach into their pocket, he'd say, "No, I don't want your money. I want the bank's money." And then he would go out of his way to find the mortgage deeds and take them and burn them. So a guy like Pretty Boy Floyd, when he died, they were all killers. They were all awful. Don't think I glamorize them. It's just the opposite. But 20,000 people showed up for Pretty Boy Floyd's funeral.
Oh, that's impressive. But tell me, Bill, have you ever been threatened in any way about your book or projected books?
When I started my research, the most powerful man that came to Vegas was afraid that my research would put him in prison. And he made it very clear.
And who was that?
He didn't want me to continue, but there was no direct threat, and after I was part of the industry and knew his close associates for many years, he and I became dear friends, but that's the closest thing I came to. One gangster,
what, can you mention
I'd
his
ask
name?
Him a question he didn't like, he'd point a gun at me, but I think he was doing that more to impress a kid than as a real threat.
All right, but apparently you're not mentioning names now.
The public wouldn't know these names. These aren't Ben Siegel's. These were the guys that ran Vegas. The man that was the most influential criminal that ever came to town that didn't want me to continue my research was named Mo Dalitz.
Oh, Mo, yeah. I refer to him in my book. And
okay,
he's not mentioned at all in your book.
Well, see, mine is the Depression era in the 40s, and these men arrived in the 50s.
Right.
They will be in the future. I'll have their whole lives. I spent with these guys, these main people, anywhere from 50 to 100 hours in interviews over many years. So their whole life, their value systems, how they came to such power, most of them out of very impoverished situations, they're just all amazing stories.
Okay, but I mentioned, while going through your book, I see that you you mention Hoover, and you also mention Tolson, but there's no mentioning of the two of them being like together in bed or anything like that. You know, I know it's kind of salacious, but people kind of like that stuff.
No, you missed those sections because it's very important to who they were. I give stronger evidence than anyone had because no one ever saw them actually in the bedroom. But I give stronger evidence, combine it, than anyone before because their closeted behavior affected their whole way of dealing with people. So, no, it goes into great detail. Going back through the newspapers and magazine articles, early in Hoover's career, there was a man who wrote an article for Collier's magazine that listed all of his faults and mismanagement, and the world didn't take him seriously. And then 3 years later, the Chicago Tribune did a humongously long article going over the same material plus a bunch more, and no one realized that this man not only didn't enforce the law, he was manipulating politicians and had his own agenda. And it applies to today. I'm not getting into whether the NSA should be in surveillance or not, domestic surveillance or not, because that's a current issue, and I'm an historian. But this book shows what happens when a secret organization is not held accountable by Congress.
And he had great
PR.
What he did
was outrageous.
Yeah, real quickly, Bill, we're getting to this break, and you stay with us. We're going to finish out the show with you. But again, while going through your book, you hardly mention much about Meyer Lansky. You have one line about Sheriff Lamb, who they had a series about on TV.
Okay, Stan.
But we have to break.
You're listening to The View from Over Here, heard on CRN Digital Talk Radio and carried on the World Wide Web at crntalk.com. Stay tuned for more.
Hi, this is Stan Weisleder in the studio with Malcolm Berman and our special guest today, Bill Friedman, who wrote a fascinating book, All Against the Law. Bill, real quickly, I saw in your book that you have a lot of references to all kinds of shenanigans taking place in Kansas City, and that made me think of the line from the song, Everything is Up to Date in Kansas City, okay? And you have a lot of references to Kansas City and Harry Truman, which I never knew, which most people never knew. But most people know about what has taken place since about 1960 or the last half of the previous century. When is your new book going to come out, which talks about what most of us know?
But that's down the road, because there's a lot of incredible history that I was fascinated with, that I studied. So this book and the next book are the early years, and then it starts moving ahead.
Can you give us an idea what years or eras or decades the next few books will cover?
The next book will be the 20s through the 40s, the illegal activities of the biggest gangsters in America, and who were the ones who built the Las Vegas Strip. It was an open city. Anyone could open a hotel here, but businessmen, legitimate businessmen, didn't know gaming. So 80% of the hotels from the Flamingo through Caesar's Palace were built by these gangsters.
Is Reno part of that also?
Pardon?
Reno, is that part of that?
Reno was in the early days. See, this book keeps bouncing back and forth. Reno was the biggest city back then, and they catered to there was no tourism in America. Except for the wealthy, no one took vacations. And so to get people outside of Reno to come in, the two big gaming operators there built a financial emporium that catered to financial criminals, and they catered to all their needs. And so all of these public enemies, number one, these bank robbers, the four that were identified by the attorney general in a row, they all hid out there for long periods within weeks to a few months of the FBI finally taking them down. And so the hoodlums of America, that was a favorite spot for them when they wanted to avoid appearing in court or they were fugitives. But otherwise, no, Reno after that was a very straight town.
How about as far as the gambling, let's say, in Cuba or Puerto Rico? Was this influenced by the organized crime? Were they the same people?
Puerto Rico, no. Totally different phenomenon. I've worked there several times as a consultant because I spent my whole life in the casino business and, managed on the Strip, etc. But Cuba was a conglomeration. Several Vegas interests had Cuban interests, but a lot of organized crime did. Meyer Lansky had a hotel there, for example, but so did some mafia leaders. Again, a wide-open town. Anyone who wanted to get in the gaming business.
All right,
could
Bill,
go there.
I think that's our final...
Bill, we're going to have to get back to you another day because that's our... Our hour is up.
Yeah, we want you back, and we want to see your next book, and you can preview it on our show.
And you're listening to The View from Over Here, heard on CRN Digital Talk Radio and carried on the World Wide Web at crntalk.com. You can hear us at www.viewfromoverhere.com. No view. And who do we have next week? Quick.
Sarge, the comedian that will keep you laughing so hard you will practically pee in your pants.
Have a good week. We'll speak to you next week. Ciao.
The View from Over Here is a co-production of Infinity X and TBG International. For further information, contact Malcolm Berman at 818-687-2784. That's 818-687-2784.